there are multiple points to political lies, but they're about shifting blame. They're often about identifying scapegoats, consolidating forms of political unity.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to this episode of The Raven Cast. The Raven Cast is a product of The Raven Review, an online magazine where we talk about the conflict and violence and rivalry that so often infects our world and our lives and our neighborhoods. And we try to do it through the lens of memetic theory. And today I'm really excited because I have my good friend, Stephen McKenna, on the show. And Steve, thanks for being here.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Great to see you.
I always like talking with you, Steve. Steve is the associate professor of media studies at and communication at Catholic University. And did I get it all in there?
Yeah.
Good. And I love talking with Steve because he's so informative. And Steve, you teach about rhetoric, right?
Right, that's my home field, which is to say I'm a generalist because rhetoric covers everything, right? I have some background in classics, and I'm very interested in how the whole field of rhetoric, especially classical rhetoric, was received in the 18th century and particularly in the Enlightenment, and it's a fantastic toolbox for thinking about politics, culture, literature. It's never ending, and it allows you to go in a lot of. I like to say rhetoric was the first interdisciplinary department. it covers everything.
Yeah, that's good. And I'm glad that it covers everything because I wanted to bring you on the show today to talk about politics. Rhetoric has something to do with politics. Yes.
Yes, that is it. That's true. It's the main tool of politics. You have that, and then you have violence. And when you're using violence, you're pretty much exhausted the rhetoric. The idea that rhetoric was a replacement for violence goes back to some of the earliest writings we have in the West. Suppositional writings by Cicero and Quintilian about how it is that human beings started trying to persuade one another, and their idea was that it came out of as a kind of replacement for the other option, which was physical force and violence. So that's also how I came to the Girardian wheelhouse. That's part of my interest in.
What does Girard have to offer to this to that conversation? What is it about Girard that's interesting in this?
A lot of things, but for me, I read Girard for quite a while, and said, well, that's all very interesting and very nice, but I'm a language person, and obviously its bearing on literature is very important. But there wasn't a whole lot of language theory per se in Girard's work. So at first I did some shrugging as to how I could use it. The work of Eric Gans picks up in some very interesting and useful ways that I also found useful. But I think that it really, I was working on a project having to do with propaganda. And I was interested in studying modern propaganda. I was fascinated that all of the contemporary propaganda theorists, really largely, it's a kind of a subdiscipline that grew up heavily after World War II, really in concert with the growth of communications as a discipline. And I was fascinated that all these people studying propaganda really had very little grounding in rhetoric. And they were sort of reinventing the theoretical wheel. Meanwhile, a lot of people who worked in the history and theory of rhetoric felt like that, you know, propaganda, that's kind of something to be studied in the social sciences empirically, but not very interesting. So I was working on bridging these things, and that's when Girard, the rubber hit the road for me, with really getting a very refined understanding of the nature of scapegoating. And so that was kind of the hookup for me. And then, you know, as they say, that's all she wrote.
Yeah, that's good. Well, I wanted to, like, propaganda. And in our last conversation we did about a year ago, we talked a lot about truth. And you brought up the topic of bullshit, which was fantastic.
One of my favorite topics. As a you know, as a rhetorician, I'm licensed.
You're licensed in bullshit.
Yeah, no. So it actually is a well, I was very happy last year. I did a seminar on lies and alternative facts and bullshit. I was very happy to get the word bullshit into the university catalog. It's there forever now. Good. So, but it is a specific term of art. It's been associated with the work of Princeton philosopher Harry Frankfurt, who wrote a little essay on bullshit that circulated for many years, and now you can buy it as a book. It's a tiny, tiny little thing. It's only like 50 pages long. But the essential idea of bullshit is that it is distinct from lying, and the distinction is essentially this: that the liar is somebody who knows the truth. And decides to intentionally produce an alternative thing and call it truth. So the liar, in an odd way, knows that you have to know the truth to lie. That's the idea. And the curious thing about that is that every lie in that regard pays a backhanded compliment to the truth, to kind of the existential power of truth and empirical facts and things like that. So even the liar has his own or her own twisted regard for the truth. And bullshit is distinct, according to Frankfurt, and then it's been amply cited for a long time. The bullshitter is someone who doesn't have a regard for the truth, that it may be lying, or it may feel like lying to some people, but the point is that the bullshitter doesn't feel any anchorage to the truth or any respect for it. And so there's a lot of harmless bullshit, you know, in Frankfurt talks about, you know, a bullshit session where people are just, you know, it's like fishing stories or something, where obviously it can be harmless. But in the long run, a culture of bullshit is a very pathological one, because it's one where there's no such thing as a lie anymore, and therefore there's no such thing as a truth. And so it's been sort of regularly cited as quite relevant to our political moment.
Well, I wanted to bring you on because of our political moment, in part because I'm trying to navigate my way through it, and I'm having all kinds of problems because, as you say, it seems to be in our political moment, but I don't know what to do about it, and I don't know if it's worth calling it out, and I don't know if calling it out is only like makes it worse.
Right.
And you know, we're like in this matrix of like, I don't know what the truth is anymore, because I've got like Eugene Robinson wrote this article earlier this week where he says at the Washington Post, where Trump subverts our democracy with his lies. It's as bad as that. And Eugene Robinson says that this is as bad as an impeachable offense. So there are people who are going like, seemingly like extreme on this, and then there are other people who are just like, don't take what he says literally,
right?
So there's like this interpretation of it, and I'm trying to navigate my way through it, and I'm partisan like everybody else.
I'm not
right, yes,
ruthlessly objective.
Yeah, that's why I wanted you on, so that you could tell me the truth.
Right.
So take the blinders off of my eyes for me, please.
Well, I think you're seeing things pretty well in a way. I certainly feel your anxiousness about it. The thing about bullshit or a culture that really has no regard for the truth anymore, which is really the disturbing part of, you know, say Trump's lies. It's not so much that he lies. He's made a career of it. His whole personal mythology and all of that. And on any given day, it seems like he's been on a real run lately, particularly with the Khashoggi thing. Quite tragic. But it's not so much that he lies. It's that his supporters, and I mean by that I mean both his political supporters in the GOP, but then also the people that you see in rallies and so on, they don't seem to mind, right? And if you get into and they may even say that in a peculiar way, they might even think that it shows once again how powerful Trump is, right? That he's brutally honest. and so he calls it like he sees it, an ugly sort of Machiavellian fact, but that's all well and good with some people. So, you know, the thing about a culture of bullshit like that with real disregard for the truth is that you can't navigate it. You can't paddle your canoe through bullshit. There is no navigating it. And I've also pondered that question. Eugene Robinson's piece was one of hundreds of pieces. I mean, you know, the New York Times keeps a sort of running tab of the daily untruths, and it's not only confined to Trump, of course, but he seems to be setting the paradigm, as it were. So there have been lots of these, lots and lots and lots of these pieces, sort of enumerating the lies, the untruths, the alternative facts, in kind of scandalized outrage and finger wagging and all of that. And it's a good question as to whether it's worth it. I mean, I think it is worth it, although there are hazards to be involved in the debunking business, as it were. To some extent, you're playing the game, of course, because the point of the political, there are multiple points to political lies, they're about shifting blame. They're often about identifying scapegoats, consolidating forms of political unity, and so on. But in a media environment like ours, they're also about taking up oxygen. They're about, you know, there are these shiny objects that get tossed on the floor in front of the journalists, and they all go pick them up and say, look at this, this one's really a whopper. And so as a diversionary tactic and as a way of controlling media attention, the persistent lying is a very, very, sad to say, it's a very functional strategy. And so to the extent that you get, that you spend your time debunking them one after another, you're playing the game. And to the extent that you become very, to let yourself get too scandalized by it, you know, the debunkers often are like mimetic doubles of the ones that they're debunking. This is a kind of an important theme in conspiracy theory, which I'm teaching about right now. And Chris Fleming and Emma Jane have a wonderful book on it that we mentioned before.
I have it here, actually.
Do you?
Yeah, yes, there you go. Right. Modern Conspiracy, The Importance of Being Paranoid.
That's right, right. It's a wonderful read. It's pretty much the last word on conspiracy theory, at least for now. And one of the great points that Chris and Emma make in the book is the way in which the culture of debunking often operates as a kind of rival to the liar and can fall into its own traps of self-righteousness that are certainly pretty hazardous. So I don't know if I can take your blinders off. I think you're right to be disoriented right now. Another interesting thing that comes sort of out of the tangent of it's not really a tangent of conspiracy theory. Conspiracy theories really can thrive in a culture of lying and a culture of bullshit. One of the sort of explanatory concepts that's been brought up a fair amount is the idea, it's called agency panic. It's associated originally, I think, with a guy by the name of Timothy Melley, M-E-L-L-E-Y. And there's this sociological concept that's been around for a long time called moral panic, right? And moral panics are these moments when there's some very alarming new thing and there's a huge amount of cultural attention that becomes focused on it way out of proportion to the damage. You know, we have our own versions of it now. MS-13 is a great example. It's not that MS-13 is not bad, but, you know, they're not coming in my window right now. So Melley takes this idea of agency panic, of moral panic, and he shifts it and he talks about agency panic. And right now, I think it's a useful term to have around, because I think that's a little bit of what you're feeling. It's the sense that if we don't have, if we can't rely on the truth, if we can't point to facts that will anchor us and orient us so that we can do the political things that we need to do, then it leaves us completely incapacitated in a democracy, especially, you know. So we feel, you know, what Melley calls agency panic, this sense of like, I've lost my agency here. I don't have the ability to control my environment. There's no happy narrative I can tell to myself to make sense of day-to-day life in the world. You know, all I can do is sort of watch the news every day and just my eyes get bigger and I feel sort of paralyzed. And that is, I think, something that I've heard from lots of people, from my students. And it's aggravated in a media environment like ours, where you're just, there's this fire hose of information coming at you all the time. And so in the absence of, in a sense of debilitated agency, people, at least in Melley's thinking, that's one of the reasons people go to conspiracy theories. A conspiracy theory becomes a kind of what I would call a compensatory epistemology. It becomes, well, you know, I can't stand the Clintons, let's say, and Hillary Clinton, and, you know, the Clintons have been involved in all of these, you know, disappearances of people, but the real explanation is that they're shape-shifting lizards or something like that, you know. So the conspiracy theory becomes this kind of way of re-narratizing the world and reclaiming some kind of agency. Now it's a complete simulacrum of reality, but I think that is really part of the psychology of it, and that certainly seems to be alive in our culture. We heard the president. You know, we've heard, like you were talking a couple weeks ago about the Kavanaugh hearings, and now there's been, you know, this that it was, the whole thing was a conspiracy from 12 years ago or something like that. And, because then that's a compensatory explanation for people who just don't want to believe what's pretty much under their noses. And you have Trump talking about MBS's claim that there was rogue killers. Yeah. Right. So, you know, that's an MS-13 like explanation for this brutal killing. So
that's
a lot of things there to throw out, but those are kind of things floating around in my head about the moment right now.
Yeah, we've got a comment, just Wesley saying hello. So hi, Wesley, and anybody else watching, feel free to comment and I'll bring you in. So earlier in this week, I was feeling, what was the term that you were just talking about?
Agency panic.
I was feeling so much agency panic. I was like swirling in depression is too far, but I was like, oh my God, what are we going to do? We can't do anything. And I was listening, I don't forget what show it was, but they were saying, this is exactly how the powers and principalities work. They foist, whether intentionally or not intentionally, they foist this sense of agency on you, that you can't do anything. And they want you to feel like you're defeated and that you can't do anything and that your vote doesn't matter. So just stay home because you're just one among many. So you have no agency in this. And I was like, damn, if that's what they're wanting to do, I'm not going to fall for that.
Right. I mean, this is your problem. See, your problem is that you're too smart to buy into the, you have the agency panic, but you're not willing to drink the Kool-Aid. And so that's my free therapy for today.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Is that the answer to agency panic? Is it, I don't know, but transform it or look at it in a different way? Or I'm basically getting back to, damn it, we're in a world of bullshit and I want to navigate it.
Right.
But I can't.
Right. Well, you know, I think it, you know, the theological answer is hope, right?
Yeah.
That you have to hope that the better angels of our nature will resume control, or to the extent that they ever have, and that our political foundations, although they've been damaged a lot in the last couple of years, but that they're strong. They're much stronger than the moment that we're going through right now. So, I think that there has to be some hope. I think there has to be, my own way of dealing with it is a certain amount of, empirical detachment, and sort of remember what's really important on a day-to-day basis, because otherwise you would just be, you know, like in this state. And I think it is potentially, you know, psychologically damaging for some people. One of the things that I was thinking about along the psychology of it, and Marty Reinecke would be a good person to talk about this one too, but I was talking with my students about conspiracy theory and, you know, so why would the Trump supporters simply give a pass to the president when he says, you know, well, I never said that, and then someone can roll the videotape of him saying that. And I think it points to a kind of schizophrenic state. It's like they know he's lying, they know that they can watch the video and they can hear him saying what he says one minute and then what he says he never ever said the next minute. And the only way to sort of maintain the very heavy cognitive dissonance that demands is to just sort of draw a line down the middle, and it requires almost a kind of schizophrenic state, and it's not healthy. So you have to keep reminding yourself of the facts and educating yourself. I also find really useful is satire. Satire is propaganda's worst enemy, because satire, its main discursive mode is through irony, right? So when we watch, the best example was Stephen Colbert when he was Stephen, and we knew when we were watching him that the outrageous things he was saying were the exact opposite of what he meant. And it's very funny, and he's quite a genius. But the important thing about satire is that it's constantly reminding us that that meanings are in flux, and that meanings are based on differences. They're not based on the sort of hard referential logic that propagandists want to operate by. You know, like when Goebbels is referring to Jews as vermin. I mean, you could say it's a metaphor, but at a certain level, it's a dead metaphor as far as the Nazis were concerned. And this points at the way a lot of propaganda has this kind of earnestness about it. Well, I'm very serious about this. You know, there may be a little joking here and there, but it's like when Trump tells his jokes at his rallies, and everybody laughs, but he's not really joking. He doesn't seem to have a real sense of humor very much. So I find satire very, very reassuring. It means that precisely because language is a metaphorical system, that we're not trapped by it. We're not trapped by singular interpretations. We can find our way around, propagandistic abuses of the truth. And so that's one way out of bullshit, I think.
I like it. So yes. Stephen Colbert, as we knew him 10 years ago or whenever it was, is no longer around. Do you recommend anyone who's doing this well?
I'm an old Colbert fan, so okay. I still watch him quite regularly, at least his opening. It's a dose of sanity before I go to bed. Yeah. And I like Trevor Noah a lot. Yeah. Like Trevor and the people that he has on his show are terrific. And you know, one of the ways in which Noah is he's very meta. You know, I think he's completely conscious of the way that satire is playing this meaning game that gives us access back to meaning, because he'll move between these things, like when he was talking the other day about the real brazenness of Trump's approach to the Jamal Khashoggi thing, he said something like, you know, well, I've gotta hand it to Trump. He really is honest there in a certain way. He's what does he say? He wears his moral corruption on his sleeve or something like that. And so you have these moments where the laughter kind of breaks and you're like, well, yeah, that is what's going on. But you can get back to that. You can see, oh yeah, that is wearing his moral corruption on his sleeve. It's not just another passable lie. You get to that though because you've been dosed with some satire and reminded of how meanings really work and how they circulate.
Is that one of the hopeful things during the Trump presidency, is that he wears his moral corruption on his sleeve and we can see it, whereas previous presidents hide it so well?
Well, I would say there's a false equivalence there between the moral corruption of all previous presidents. I mean, you know, I guess you could drag Buchanan in here if you wanted. But I do think that in a backhanded way, there is a a kind of service that has been done by Trump, because, you know, this is hardly an original thought. He's not the problem. He's a symptom of the problem. And he's just particularly good at channeling it and understanding our weaknesses, our proclivities to be scandalized and then fall into scapegoating. You know, his whole stance on immigrants that really began on day one when he came down that escalator is premised on that. And so in a certain way, he's done us a favor by, you know, yanking the Band-Aids off and showing us our own woundedness and our own worst proclivities. You know, I mean, when you think about you know, the alt-right and the rise of a kind of quasi-sanitized white nationalism, right? It's nationalism. You see, it's not white supremacy. And I remember seeing, we were horrified when we saw what happened at Charlottesville. But I also felt like, well, you know, these guys, these ideas, these thoughts, they were here. It's just that, you know, now that the lights are off, the cockroaches are running out. Well, there's something good about seeing that ugliness out in the open, you know. Have you seen the film? Oh, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, in the town, like right, just right there from me, there have been all kinds of Nazi posters and things going up in Jewish neighborhoods and synagogues, and Portland has some Nazi past and white supremacist stuff, right. But this is like just the last couple of years, it's just been intensified. So
you know, it made me think. I recently saw Black Klansman. Have you seen that?
I haven't seen that one.
Yeah. No. Oh, we could do a whole show on that.
Let's
one.
Do it.
Very
yeah.
interesting. Along a lot of thematic lines that we're talking about right now. Yeah.
Well, we'll watch it and we'll have another discussion on it. And thank you for bringing in hope. And I needed some of that. So yes. And every time I talk with you, I feel like I'm okay. I'm okay.
Good. You are.
So
you will be.
Yes.
I think we all will be. But you know, it also means that, you know, we got to roll up our sleeves and we have work to do. You got to vote.
Yeah.
If people get cowed and feel, you know, too much agency panic, you know, why even vote? You know, well, that's a dangerous mistake too. So,
yep.
So absolutely. I'll be voting in the midterms for sure.
Me too, my friend. Yeah. Me too. Yeah. So good. Well, thank you so much for being here, and we'll talk again soon.
Yeah.
All right.
Great.
Take
Thanks.
Care.
Talk soon. Bye.
Bye.